Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week with Dr. T, our weekly news program posted every Monday morning at 11 a.m., but it is available for you to watch it at any time. We hope that you've joined. We hope that you've been enjoying our podcasts, which are listed daily now at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. We have a lot of different varieties of shows that some, we feel like we've got something for everyone's time. We hope by now you've joined our new Tenpenny Prime membership, the new education programs that are for our members only, that are a topical white paper that I write. It's usually about 25, 30 pages, a recorded educational presentation, and a live event with the expert of the month called Ask the Expert on the last Wednesday night of the month. Here we are in May, and our focus in May has been neurological health and brain health. And at the end of the month, we're going to have Dr. Ted Fogarty on to talk about hyperbaric oxygen and about the importance of glutathione for the brain. So you won't want to miss that. That is part of your membership if you are a Prime member. If you're not a Prime member, there's a way for you to join up and to join us on that Wednesday night. And as you see from our website, also from our email list, you'll get notifications on that. We have, if you are not a Prime member and you would like to become a Prime member and support all the work that we do, go to shoptenpenny.net, hover over the membership tab, and you will see the direct way to become a member. Your membership, your monthly membership, is what keeps us going and keeps us allowed to do the, all the incredible work that we do to provide information for you. We have made the year 2025 be the year of knowledge, empowerment, and action. So we thank you so much for your continued support. And with that, before I introduce to you today's special guest, Christopher Shaw, to talk about his two books. And I'm telling you, he couldn't just write one. He'd write two books, both 500 pages long. So we're going to talk about both of them this morning. Down the COVID Rabbit Hole, Independent Scientists and Physicians Unmask the Pandemic. And the other book, COVID-19, A Pandemonium, the Pandemic of Ignorance, Fear, and Greed, the Capture of Our Institutions. And believe me when I say it was an enormous amount of material. I just got his ebooks just over the weekend, and it was, I spent most of the weekend reviewing the material, trying to get ready for this interview today. So it's going to be really loaded and packed with information, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say on some very specific topics. So you won't want to miss this. We're going to take a really short break. We will be right back.
Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant, you can take it when you're nursing, you can give it to little children, you can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water, because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out. The heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch within our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years.
Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Christopher Shaw is a renowned neuroscientist, author, and outspoken voice in the medical freedom movement. He's a full professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences at the University of British Columbia, with cross appointments to the programs in neuroscience and experimental medicine in the Department of Pathology. His main area of research concerns animal models for the origins of and possible therapeutic treatments for ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. He has published more than 150 peer-reviewed articles, has written three books, and has authored chapters in several books. He serves as the co-chairman of the Scientific Medical and Advisory Committee of the Canadian Citizens Care Alliance. His two recent co-edited publications, Down the COVID Rabbit Hole, Independent Scientists and Physicians Unmask the Pandemic, and his second book, COVID-19 Pandemonium, a pandemic of ignorance, fear, and greed, the capture of our institutions, are two incredible compilations of all the material that we've been talking about for the last 5 years, an incredible amount of work that went into these. So, Chris, I'm so excited to talk to you about all the work that you've done, and welcome so much to This Week with Dr. T. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on today. And it was interesting you mentioned right off the bat when you were talking about future shows, hyperbaric oxygen. That's something I'm beginning to look at with some seriousness, because it's been applied to Lou Gehrig's disease, which is my main area of study, but it's never been done thoroughly. And I would like to try and convince some people in your Department of Defense, one of the agencies that gives grants for Lou Gehrig's disease. I think I'm going to try really hard to convince them that it's worth a pilot study. So anyway.
Do you know Dr. Ted Fogarty?
I do not, but the name is familiar. I may have met him once. I should definitely, if you have a link, I'd love to talk to him, because
he's an invasive radiologist.
Okay.
And he's licensed in like 12 states or something like that. He does a lot of different things, but his passion for the last, well, almost as long as I've known Ted, maybe 12, 15 years, has really been about hyperbaric. He's published articles. He's worked with other people about it. There have been studies already. There have been studies done through the Department of Defense, and he can put that all, you know, tell you all of the background and all the things he's done. And he would be a great person for you to talk to if you're looking.
Absolutely would. Yeah. No, thank you very much. I appreciate that, because I'm not finding much in the literature. So, I don't want to, go in with an application that, again, doesn't have all the current literature. And if Dr. Fogarty has it, I'd sure love to see it.
Well, if he doesn't have it, he's connected to the people who would have. So after we finish the show here today, I'm glad to exchange information and make sure that you get connected with him.
That would be awesome. That's perfect timing. Thank you.
Well, good. Well, let's start with a controversial topic. Let's start with right away. Let's start with the virus, natural versus lab created.
Yes.
And so go ahead and give us your take on that.
Well, I think if we're talking about COVID-19, I think it's pretty clearly lab created. I think, we wrote about this in the book. Our view in the first book was, maybe it's in the second book. But it originally started off as one book, by the way. We had to divide it because Skyhorse was having a seizure because it was too, we gave them a 1,000-page book and they didn't really want something that big. They thought we could use it as doorstops, but which you probably could, I suppose. One of the chapters that deals with the origin of COVID-19, and that's a chapter by my co-editor, Stephen Pellick, who's also a professor at UBC. And basically, it's pretty clear that it did come out of the Institute of Virology in Wuhan, with American money and all that silliness of Peter Daszak and the others. And it was created there, as major, superpowers all play this game. They make these bioweapons with the view that somehow that making the bioweapon is going to enable them to fight the bioweapon that someone else makes. It's a little bit like, the analogy is, like the fire department goes and burns down half your city to demonstrate how effective they are at stopping someone burning down your city. So somebody did that. And, the lab leak is the most viable hypothesis in my view. It didn't go through pangolins and it didn't go through gerbils and elephants and ground sloths or anything else. It was a lab made modification of a bat coronavirus. And they were screwing around with it. And somebody walked out the door with stuff on their shoe or, however it got away. And so it's a lab escape issue. Could it have happened in Fort Detrick? Sure, it could have happened there. It could have happened in, with the various level 4 containment labs, the French and the Russians and the British all have. So, but it happened to happen. It seems to have happened in Wuhan. And so I think various agencies of the U.S. government are beginning to recognize that's probably what happened. And, we said so, John Oler of the Journal of Vaccine Theory, Practice and Research wrote this several years ago. So I think it's pretty clear that that was the origin. And, it was modified to make it more infective. And, it's not very pathological, but, presumably more pathological as well. And designed for humans. Yeah.
It seems as though, you know, over the last 5 years, I mean, from then until now, we've got the advantage of the great retrospectoscope. You know, we can all backwards, and it seems as though that should not be a point of contention, or why are we even discussing it anymore, instead of looking at it as this, there's no doubt about it, this was made somewhere in a lab. Why do you think that's still controversial?
Well, I think in the case of Wuhan, I think the American government under the previous administration was determined not, well, even under the previous Trump administration, was determined not to blame the Chinese, because they didn't want to make it a bone of contention between the different governments that somebody just screwed up. And so, you know, it was easier if it just happened to come through the food market and pangolins or whatever else they were raising there. But, you know, the reality is that's just not what happened, I don't think. And so, you know, I think there was a lot of denial that was more political than scientific. And I know there have been some articles that have claimed that it was a natural event, but it really wasn't. And there was a scholar at the Broad Institute named Aliyah Chen who actually wrote about this back in, I think, 2020 or 2020, early 2021, and basically said, look, this is pretty much what happened. When you look at how adapted this entity already is, it probably didn't get there through natural evolution. It probably got there through being tinkered with, and I think that's correct. And you know, all the evidence that I've seen since then has pretty much reinforced that view. And you know, suppressing that was a political and social decision, not a scientific one.
And I do also think they suppressed it because of the gain of function research that was not supposed to be happening.
Well, absolutely correct. And there, it wasn't supposed to be happening. We know the HHS, under at that time, Fauci's branch of NIH was basically funding it. And, you know, that character, Peter Daszak, was driving the boat and, you know, trying to make it seem as if it was just a natural phenomenon, but it wasn't. And, you know, hiding the gain of function research. And again, you know, the idea of the gain of function research is, let's make this thing, you know, the official reason is, let's make this thing because someone else is going to do it, and this will help us fight it better when the other guys do it. Again, but it's, again, like burning down your city to see how your fire department works. And you know, the major powers do this, and it could just look, it could just as easily have come out of Fort Detrick or any of the other level four laboratories around the world. Could have come out of Winnipeg, Canada. I mean, they're all screwing around with this kind of stuff. And you know, that's why if President Trump actually is serious about banning gain of function research, that would be a really, really good thing, because that has the potential to unleash havoc on the world. And or at least, you know, manufactured havoc, because, you know, remember the disease itself was not that lethal for most people. It was the people who succumbed to it. But there were several reasons for that. One is they had comorbid conditions. Usually they were elderly. They were in situations where they were in contained spaces like care homes, which had the earliest fatalities and serious illnesses. And it, by and large, it's not that dangerous a disease, and especially as it mutates, because viruses do go through this kind of common trajectory, which is they become more infectious and less lethal. That's sort of the way they work. And you know, as it's evolved, as things do in the viral world, they basically become less pathological, but more infectious. And that's exactly what happens. So the fear mongering, you know, you have to lay it at the front steps of government and the media. The media whipped this into complete frenzy, which it should never have been. And they made, you know, they and brought down a whole host of regulations and lockdowns and, you know, all kinds of pandemic issues that were basically less about the disease and more about control. And I think we know that. And, you know, we saw it in the States. We saw it, you know, in spades in Canada. You know, we are one of the most restricted countries on the planet, and we remain that way. Australia, the I-5 countries were arguably some of the worst in terms of the restrictions on human freedom, based on a lot of fear mongering and really poor science and bad, extremely bad modeling. The modeling was appalling, and it led us to the state today where people are terrified of the next pandemic. And we saw it, we've seen that reflected, you know, in the bird flu. I think you guys are, you know, seeing the hysteria about that. Now measles is supposedly is going to destroy the world, et cetera. So, you know, these are the kind of things that the media and governments love because they can manipulate the heck out of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, that brings up my second question that I formulated to ask you, because I really want to have an answer from a bench research scientist like yourself, who's very knowledgeable about virus and viral diseases. Mm-hmm. What do you say to this growing contingent of people who claim that viruses don't exist?
Well, I mean, I try and teach critical thinking as, you know, something we do in the, we try and do in the book. And I think it's always good to ask questions. Okay. I think, you know, and questioning established science or theoretical science is, you know, it's great. It's good. Question everything. In this case, I think the evidence that viruses do exist is pretty well established through a whole series of things, through nucleotide sequences, through EM imaging, through a whole range of studies that go back into the 1930s, you know, really with the development of the electron microscope. And so, you know, I think the idea that they don't exist is based on misunderstandings of both kind of how nucleic acids work and how you know what you're looking at under a microscope. And you know, when people say you can't purify it, well, you can never purify something that small to 100% purity. And so, a lot of the opponents of what I guess you'd say a viral existence is based on the idea, and I think a mistaken idea, that science proves things it doesn't. Science is about probability, always. You know, mathematics and formal logic are about proof. Science is not. Science is always probability. So nothing is ever 100%. You're not going to get a proof out of a scientific study, not even any collection of scientific studies. And so the idea is based on, I think, a misunderstanding of how science actually works, and trying to ignore really decades of fairly I think quantitative and reliable science. So it's not a recent discovery that viruses exist.
It's interesting, because in my new book that just came out, you know, my new book, it's Zero Accountability in a Failed System. In the third chapter, I write a section on current controversies.
Yeah.
And because I figure if I'm going to write a whole book about viruses, I better address
it. You should, yeah. So what do you think?
These people are loud, and they're angry, and they're not, many of them are not very nice. You know, they instead of just saying we have a difference of opinion here, we're finding one more thing to divide us. And my position is that I make up 4 points of why I do believe viruses exist. And one of them is these extremely complex taxonomies that they can all put together, and they name these viruses and all these things. It's like, that seems like an awful lot of work and an awful lot of data and information for something that doesn't exist.
I completely agree with you. So, I mean, I think it's, I mean, I think some people don't like being challenged. Mm-hmm. You know, I, as a scientist, I welcome it. I mean, that's how I learn stuff. I'm learning all the time. But I think there is a lack of kind of reciprocity from the no virus exist folks, that they can't stand to be challenged. And I've seen it several times. We had a couple of instances where people challenged discussions about viral diseases on our CCCA roundtable. And I know, you know, it's fine for them to do that, but then they get very hot and bothered when you don't accept it. Yeah. And again, that's not, you know, the scientific, it's not supposed to be the scientific way. I've seen some pretty good fights in science, but
And one of the other points that I made was that one of the arguments is it doesn't follow Koch's postulates. So I dug back into research material from the 1930s,
yep,
and found documented papers that said, you know, the discovery of viruses came after the put together of the Koch postulates, and they really, you know, Koch postulates were meant to be kind of a guide; they weren't supposed to be an absolute, and we have to make accommodations for other things. And so it's good to hear a bench research scientist sort of say, wait a minute, you know, I understand why you're questioning this, but there's no reason for you to be so angry and so nasty about it.
Very, very true. I mean, and the simplest experiment you can do, I mean, anyone who has kids, especially in, you know, little kids, watch what happens when a kid with a cold goes into a school.
Right.
And
I've said that, you know, or explain, I've never heard, and I also write about this in the book, that I've never heard a really good explanation for chickenpox parties or measles or why rabies, you know, if you get bit by a rabid animal, you know, what is that all
Exactly.
come from? That that really doesn't come from EMFs or 5Gs or...
It doesn't. No, it doesn't. And no, exactly. Because, you know, that's long before. And Koch's postulates, as you say, you know, they, you know, they're hard to satisfy. And he was talking about bacteria. Right. So, I mean, in any case, and, you know, even so, it's hard to demonstrate these things. And, you know, there's some questionable, I think, you know, ethical questions. You know, would you want to deliberately infect somebody with something to demonstrate that Koch's postulate was correct? I mean, it you know, but again, you know, you don't have to. You go into any elementary school and you can see it playing out. Well, they, you know, my kids go to their school. They come back with colds. I get the colds, et cetera. And we go around and round and round. And, you know, my littler kid who doesn't have it, you know, he gets it too. So that's, and they're healthy and they eat well and, you know, they're, you know, all those good things. And yet still, you know, still there are, you know, there are impacts of whatever's circulating. Now, the impact on my children is less than children who have comorbid conditions, but that doesn't mean that they're not exposed to something. And that's something, and it's not exosomes flying in the air and things like that. It is almost certainly the viral particles that have been identified over and over and over and over again for, you know, for better part of 100 years.
Fine, yeah. Well, let's move on to another section in your
sure.
book. Talk about PCR testing
in
the whole book.
One of my favorites.
Yes, good. And I said a lot during COVID. I said, we don't really have a pandemic. We have a test-demic.
Oh, we do. Yeah.
We had, you know, Carrie Mullis saying we were never supposed to use this to diagnose disease.
No.
And so what was your conclusion after you put together all that information in the books about?
Well, what, you know, I mean, PCR can be used to identify nucleotide sequences. That's true. But again, it's meant for, you know, it's meant for, you know, identifying that something may exist. For example, we've used it before to see, you know, whether or not there could be gene modifications by aluminum, for example. In this case, you know, the number of cycles you use, it's called the cycle threshold, has to be actually fairly restricted. I mean, if you multiply, and Mullis and others have said so, if you multiply things endlessly, and you get up above about 22, 24 cycles, you're going to find anything you want. It simply doesn't exist. And in, you know, the fact that you can find some nucleotide sequences or bits, and that's what you're finding at that point, you're finding bits, and you're saying that that's an infectious thing, and it's not. It's simply not anymore. And, you know, these things are fairly degraded by the time, you know, if you need to run it at 40 cycles in order to see it. It's nothing. It's not infectious. So there are reams of studies out there that show that anything above about 20, 22, 24 cycles is essentially non-infectious particles. So, you know, and that's what governments were doing, and that's what health agencies were doing routinely here in British Columbia. They were running at 38 cycles, 38 to 40. Well, because, you know, they in other words, the false positives at that level are about 97%.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, and so when it's claiming that these are identifying COVID victims is simply nonsense at that time. It may mean that they had COVID, but most of us did. My colleague, Steve Pellick, who wrote one of those chapters and is the co-editor of these two books, basically estimates from his research that probably about well over 50, maybe 80% of the population of British Columbia had experienced COVID-19. In the summer of 2020.
Wow.
Okay. Well, and yeah. So what are they measuring now? I mean, it just, you know, they're measuring fragments of people who are no longer infectious if they ever were.
You know, when all of that sort of blew up and the world should have known about it was when that lab, this was early on, like, you know, early of 2020, there was a lab in Georgia that 100% of their swabs came back positive, which is just a statistical impossibility.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody's going to be sick from something else. You know, they're going to, you know, whether it's the, you know, strep or whatever it is, it's going to be something else. And when 100% of, you know, thousands and thousands of labs come in are positive or said to be positive, and then they investigated it, and that's where the cycle threshold started to show up, that they were setting everything around 40. And so it was finding it everywhere. And people forgot that the coronaviruses, the garden variety coronaviruses, have been around since the 60s. And that
they've been around for a lot longer than the 60s.
At least that's how far back that we started talking.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So tell us about, because that's also the reason why we came up with this thing about asymptomatic transmission, which led to all the testing. And you have a whole section in your book on that.
That's right. So, I mean, asymptomatic transmission really doesn't occur. I mean, you know, the fact is you and we have a whole chapter that talks about the chain of transmission and infectious diseases. If you are asymptomatic, you are probably past the stage where you're going to infect anybody. And you're certainly not producing enough particles of whatever it is, you know, whether it's viruses or anything else that is actually going to infect anybody else. So, you know, the idea that someone can be walking around and spewing whatever, you know, at random, even though they have no symptoms, it's pretty unlikely. So I think, you know, most of the agencies have backed away from that idea. So, I mean, because that was, you know, another way, if you're not tested and we can't demonstrate that you have no PCR levels that we are going to consider infectious, therefore you could still be a danger and you can, until we test you and liberate you from the lockdowns. But that was all fiction. That was imaginary stuff. And you know, you can question why governments did that. And I think we probably have some pretty good ideas why they did that. You know, but you know, what it was, the old Rumsfeld never let a good crisis, you know, go to waste. Well, you know, various governments did the same thing. And it was interesting how all in lockstep they were all saying the same thing. All the Western governments and governments of other places as well, saying the same stuff, using the same words, and it was all like they were reading from the same script. I suspect they were. And when you see that kind of stuff, I don't know if you know Brass Check TV, but every now and then they'll do. It's a kind of an entity that broadcasts a whole bunch of stuff, interesting stuff, documentaries and film clips on controversial issues of the day. And they've done a couple where they put up, you know, multiple talking heads all saying exactly the same thing, using the same words and the same phrases. You know, like that's not spontaneous. That's a script. Yeah. I know this. My parents used to be screenwriters, and you know, you're reading a script. That's what it was.
Not only you're reading a script, you're spewing propaganda.
It's, you know, propaganda. I mean, the news today. I mean, our Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is essentially an arm of the government. It's like Pravda in the bad old days of the Soviet Union. You're basically this is official state government. Propaganda, and that's what they do, and they continue doing it. They did it during our recent election. They continue to do it throughout COVID. It's actually to the level of it's embarrassing actually watching them do it, and to the point where I don't trust anything they say. I mean, the weather reports maybe, but that's about it. You know, there's nothing else that they say that you can trust. They just make stuff up.
Wow.
And we have actually in the second book we have a chapter on that. We have a chapter on the capture of the media. We are, you know, we're talking about Canada, but the media have been, you know, significantly captured in this country, to the point where, unless you are just a blind believer, you can't trust anything they say. Unless you trust government propaganda, that is.
It's not just Canada. It's not just Canada. It's probably every country of the world, actually. You know, just head shaking for me to think that every single country in the entire big world, I mean, countries like the Seychelles sitting out in the middle of the Indian Ocean, or Guam, you know, one of our protectorates sitting out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, all of them went into lockdowns and were afraid that they were going to get this virus. Seriously? I mean, how did they convince the entire world to do that? By our captured institutions that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, captured institutions, and you know, to go against that narrative was going to get you punished or ostracized or, you know, whatever they feared was going to happen. And remember, at least in Canada, the government was throwing huge money at all the media outlets. They were actually being paid to report certain things, And, you know, in our former Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, even bragged about it at one point in his speech. He said, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, but he said something along the lines of, you know, people say, you know, we have too much control over the media, and ha ha ha. Well, we should, because we throw so much money at them. Yeah, well, it was basically true. He did say that. You go back and you say, could he really have said that? Yeah, he really said that. The same way our provincial health officer was talking about glory holes. I don't know if you know what those are. But I'll spare your audience the gory details. But anyway, you know, you couldn't have sex with your partner early days of the pandemic. You had to do it through some sort of barrier. When I wrote my other book, you know, Dispatches from the Vaccine Wars, I thought, no, I heard that, and I can't put that in. That's just can't possibly, she can't possibly have said that, but she did actually. So, things like that.
Well, one last thing before we're going to go to a quick break here. You've written quite a bit about in your books about masks.
Yes.
What's the bottom line about masks?
The bottom line about masks is they do not work to block viral transmission.
Yes, absolutely.
And anything small, they just don't. The analogy of mosquitoes through a wire mesh net is pretty accurate. Yeah.
You still see people today going masks on.
Yeah.
You see people in various places. I just shake my head. I don't know what to think about those people.
Well, they're psychologically damaged. I mean, fear does that. They are people who are so terrified and believe every bit of propaganda, and they are people living in fear. They think that these things are going to protect them, and they don't. And, you know, I mean, you know, not only the physics of you know, and the material science of masks won't do it, but also if you've ever seen kind of how people, you know, surgical masks are not meant to stop viruses, they're not. And when you watch, you know, kind of how particles come out, if they're not tightly sealed, even if they are, it kind of doesn't matter. But you watch the, you know, things blowing back past people's ears. It's like, it's ridiculous. And yet you're right. You know, I still, you know, not where I live, we don't see that much of it. But if you go down to Victoria, which is the capital city, you see people walking along. We have a seawall, a beautiful seawall there. And it's so, the wind is so brisk there. People kite surf out there. And because, you know, it's kind of howling hurricane level winds, and you see people walking all by themselves with no one around them for hundreds of meters wearing a mask. Like, wow. So, I mean, that's fear. And you see people in their cars wearing a mask. And, you know, those are psychologically traumatized people.
That's a good way to sum that up, because there's no other explanation or no other reason for it, scientific or otherwise.
And the Cochrane collaboration, you know, which is pretty, pretty reliable. I mean, they've had a few hiccups along the road, and, you know, there's been some diminution of their ability to do objective science over the years. And I think that's been reported. But they did a whole study on masks, and they said, you know, we can't find any evidence that they actually work.
Exactly.
You know, not even the N95. A full containment suit, yeah. But, you know, nobody in their right mind is walking around in a full containment suit. So, and even then, look again, how did this stuff get out of Wuhan? Because somebody, you know, didn't conceal their suit well enough, you know, or whatever it was. So,
well, we're talking today with Christopher Shaw to talk about his two books, Down the COVID Rabbit Hole, Independent Scientists and Physicians Unmask the Pandemic, and the other book, COVID-19 Pandemonium, A Pandemic of Ignorance, Fear, and Greed, the Capture of Our Institutions. This is really interesting. I've got a couple of really cool questions to ask when we come back from the break. So we're going to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
We also have an apparel line on our store that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our Opti line, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries, and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store.
Well, welcome back, everyone. So, Chris, as a neuroscientist, what do you feel is the most alarming about the data connecting the COVID jabs and spike proteins to neurological disorders with cognitive decline? There was just that big study that just came out of South Korea about a month ago that had 2 million people in it that said that the people that had the COVID jabs had much more cognitive decline in neuropsychiatric orders, disorders. And what should the public understand about these risks, and why are they being withheld?
I think they're being withheld because there is a lot of, in the medical mainstream medical community, there's a lot of unwillingness to accept that the vaccines have damaged people. You know, even you know, if they grudgingly accept that myocarditis is real, even if they grudgingly accept that the turbo cancers, the very fast aggressive cancers, are real, even if they accept that changes in fertility are real, you know, to go into the idea that neurological damage may actually be occurring. And of course, you know, it was obvious from the beginning. When I wrote my other book, I had seen a study by a company called Valera, which used to be an offshoot of Moderna. And they actually did a biodistribution study. So, okay, where does this stuff go? Where does the mRNA go? And they found it in the brain. I thought, you know, this is colony mice. But still, you know, the fact that it gets into the brain, think, okay, this cannot be a good thing, because, you know, when you put a foreign particle into your brain, your immune system is going to deal with it, and it's going to deal with it by destroying the neurons that it's on. And so now that we know that it gets there, what do you think is going to happen? So I think we have kind of an iceberg problem here. We're beginning to see the tip of the iceberg, which is going to be very damaging, I think, to society, that we have a lot of people, you know, depending on how many people got the vaxxed and double vaxxed and boosted, that are going to have neurological consequences. And these consequences are going to get worse, because neurological diseases are not particularly traditionally very fast. You know, when you look at the major age-dependent neurological diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, they don't happen overnight. They may start early in life, but they don't, you know, express, you know, that rapidly. Now we're beginning to see kind of this initial wave of, as the South Korean study has showed and others are showing, there's a ALS cluster that I'm following out of the Atlantic states and others. I'm thinking we're going to see an awful lot of neurologically damaged people. You know, I don't know what the percentage in the United States was of people who were double vaxxed. In Canada, if you believe our public health officer, which is always questionable exercise, but let's pretend she's right, that 82 or 83 or whatever it is percent of the population got double vaxxed, and now, and some of them like 30% boosted. Those are neurologically damaged people, and you know, they may die from something before the neurological damage is expressed, but I think they're all neurologically damaged. And think about the consequences to society when you think about, okay, think about neurological diseases again, go back to those ones I mentioned, Lou Gehrig's, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. When someone gets those in your family, either if you're very wealthy, you can get full-time care, or you can put them in a home, or someone in the family is going to step out of their job and care for them. And I've seen that happen in family members in my circle. So what happens now to all the stuff that functions society when a lot of people are no longer able to work because they're caring for damaged relatives, or they themselves are damaged? I think you're looking at a problem of, you know, major significance. And you know, remember, these people may live quite a long time with their neurological consequences. You know, unlike the turbo cancers, which will probably kill them fairly quickly, myocarditis, which is going to affect their heart function for the rest of their lives. But now you're looking at neurological diseases that may be slow and insidious but increasing in you know, we call it progressive. We don't mean it the same way that liberals talk about progression, but progressive in the sense they get worse. And I think you have a lot of neurologically damaged people who will not be able to function in the future. And we're seeing it in children. There are some reports of increased levels of ASD or cognitive dysfunctions in children, because a lot of mothers got vaccinated because they were told it was safe and effective, especially the safe part, with no data at all to demonstrate that. You know, and so I think, you know, we're going to be looking at a lot of damaged people increasingly in the future. You know, from the you know, those, you know, 2021 through 2024 or five, you know, maybe it's tapered off in terms of, you know, people getting the COVID vaccines. But I think we've damaged a lot of people. And the neurological stuff is the one that scares me the most, because it is going to be a challenge for society to function when that many people are not able to function as they had before. So, you know, that's the one that keeps me up at night, thinking about what do you do about this? You know, there are various protocols to get the spike protein out, but neurons don't grow back very easily. So, you know, and, you know, if you get the spike protein out of your lungs and your intestines and your left foot, yeah, you might get away with it. You getting them out of your brain, well, broken brain cells are broken brain cells, and you're not growing them back. So now what? And that's the kind of thing that I think is very concerning.
And as someone who's published so many peer-reviewed articles in neuroscientific journals, how do you interpret or take the silence or the complicity of the NIH, the HHS, the FDA? And, you know, as recently as 2 days ago, Secretary of the FDA, Marty McCurry, says, you know, was asked the question point blank, why are the COVID vaccines still on the pediatric schedule?
Yep.
Why should a completely healthy 12-year-old white girl with no comorbidities and not around anybody, why should she be given the sixth booster? And he's like, well, we'll just wait and see what the science shows. Like, seriously? I mean, that was posted all over X, and the comments underneath it were, you've just lost every bit of credibility you may have had, because we have enough data and enough information out there to choke a horse.
We do. And actually, the CCCA is leading a effort to actually get mRNA vaccines banned. And I think you've seen that. If you haven't, I'll send it to you. We have now a open letter to the various politicians in our country and to different agencies saying, listen, the science is there. Stop doing it. You're just going to make more damaged people. And unless that's what you want, you know, maybe, you know, if that's what you want, that's fine. But also keep in mind that, you know, Kennedy and the people that have been appointed to HHS, they're facing a massive industry that makes their money on exactly this. Pfizer and Moderna and the other vaccine companies made a lot of money during the last 5 years. And they're reluctant to surrender that. I mean, this was a gold mine, a very productive gold mine. And, you know, to actually admit now that they've done damage and maybe this is something they should stop is, well, again, think of tobacco science, think of any number of pesticide science, think of all the things that companies don't want to give up because it's lucrative. And, you know, the vaccine market has exploded. And at COVID-19, I can't remember how much Moderna and Pfizer each made, but it was in the multiple billions over the years. And, you know, to acknowledge that maybe they've actually damaged a lot of people, right? It's easier just to keep giving it and not ban it, rather than say, oops, sorry about that, you know, we kind of messed up here and we've kind of killed your country, sorry, you know. But that's kind of what they did, you know. Yeah. and with some of the things, people may get better, you know, the cancers. You know, Bill Mackus and others have documented that fairly extensively. But the neurological stuff is something I don't think people are going to get better from. And so it surprises me, too, that they're still on the schedule. And I think, you know, Kennedy needs to, you know, try a little harder. You know,
move on it, because, you know, with all the things with the infertility, I mean, here in the U.S., infertility rates are the lowest ever recorded right now.
Yeah.
And when you look at the COVID jabs that are given to pregnant mothers and also now given to children starting at 6 months of age, and we know that those spike proteins have a predilection for ovaries and testicles, and girls are born with a certain number of eggs and that's it.
That's it.
Time they get to childbearing age, they may have about 300,000 eggs left, which is about 25% of what they started with.
Yeah.
Well, what if they start with 100,000? Because they've been damaged by these shots.
They have.
Really talking about that.
Yeah, no, and indeed. And so McCurry needs to, you know, step up his game here, because, and no, what are they afraid of? What's going to happen? You know, okay, so the farmer's going to scream. Okay, what else is doing? You know, it's the biggest lobby group. It's the biggest lobby group in the United States. They throw money across the aisle like, you know, like it's confetti.
We need to get that message out to them saying, yeah, they're going to scream. So what? That's a great response.
No, but exactly. I mean, like, okay. So, you know, and look how they're screaming now. Oh my, you know, oh my God, you know, now everyone's going to get measles and die. Well, come on, kids. And seriously, yeah, you know, one of the reasons that people are not taking the measles shot and you know, where you might see spikes in measles, first of all, it's cyclic. It happens all the time anyway. Number two is because people don't trust you anymore because you lied through your teeth about everything COVID for 5 years. So why would they trust you? And anyway, I hope that Kennedy has a long run in his role as HHS and that Trump continues to support him, but they don't have that long. They've only got a few years to sort this house of cards out, and if that time is gone, you know, I don't know. I don't know what happens then. It's concerning. Yeah.
We're coming down to the bottom of our hour here, which has just been amazing and really, really good. Now, both of these books are over 500 pages.
Sorry about that.
Have barely skimmed across the prologue because there's so much material in there. Yeah. So what information or what message would you like to leave to our audience today about either of the books or both of them and why they're so important even now, 5 years after the fact?
Well, I mean, the first book, Down the COVID-19 Rabbit Hole, is important because I think it gives people a firm grounding in what the actual science is versus the government's media science is. And, you know which one people should look at it and evaluate it and decide which one they want to trust. I think really the take-home message is the pandemic and plandemic, whatever we want to call it, you know, the fear-mongering that drove so many people into behaving irrationally is something that we need to watch out for again. Because again, you know, they're going to do this again. You know, we know this, whether it's bird flu or measles or, you know, whichever new thing they come up with. This, you know, the pharma's model is let's keep everyone in a constant state of fear. And they're people are so dumbed down that they'll never notice and we'll scare them with gerbil flu next or, you know, whatever it is. Okay. So, you know, first of all, be aware and, you know, use your brain. You have a brain for a reason. Use your brain, learn critical thinking and, you know, look at alternative sources. Don't just believe the first thing that, you know, the media tells you. And the second thing is the second book really is about regulatory capture. All the things that we thought we could trust, we hoped we could trust, are not trustworthy. The media is captured. The judiciary, at least in Canada, is utterly captured. I don't know if you've ever heard of something called judicial notice, but judicial notice is where the court says, oh, well, the public health officer just said this is how COVID works. It must be true. Therefore, we're not going to consider any criticism of that, which is, you know, absurd. And we have a whole chapter on that. Look at, you know, so it's the media, the politicians are captured. Politicians are not always the most acute, scientifically educated people. Sadly, they should be, but they're not. You know, so the political system has been captured. You know, it's just pretty much everything in our society has come under the sway of the fear and that trifecta of media, government, and pharma drilling into people's heads constantly. You know, fear, 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 be afraid, be afraid, be afraid. Do it. You know, if you do what we tell you, everything will be fine. Well, it's not, you know, and you've seen the Cleveland Clinic study where the more times you get the COVID vaccine, the worse your outcomes become. Okay. And, you know, that has two implications. One is the more times you take the COVID vaccine, the worse your response to COVID is going to be because you're basically damaging your immune system. Mm-hmm. And the fear is that maybe you're damaging it for other things as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And so again, you know, I think if anything, the two books should tell you or teach you to question a mainstream established science that is promoted by the media and, you know, the experts and government. Always question. Yeah, question it anyway. Question anything, but question that. And, you know, begin to think about all this stuff got broken. How do we fix it? What do we do to restore trust in each other? And, you know, this is kind of a Matthias Desmet kind of concern. But how do you have a civil society where people, I mean, society depends on people trusting each other to some extent, to a great extent, actually. And if you cannot trust all these things that we thought were you know, are kind of a bedrock of society, what's left? So how do we recapture that? How do we recapture what's been captured? And I think that's going to be essential, because if we're going to go forward and not just be dictated to and dumbed down and treated like Klaus Schwab or who is a replacement, who also looks like somebody from central casting in Hollywood. Where do they find these people anyway, you know, that look like James Bond characters, honestly? Unless we do that, that's our future. That's the future, you know, of a enslaved humanity. And I think we need to begin to think of ways to recapture our humanity and our society. And without that, I don't see. I worry about this for my children. And this is what I fear for my children and my grandchildren. And if we can't do that, then I think it's going to be a dark future.
And I think that really sums it up. It sums up the last 5 years and how we, you know, I've said this 100 times, if not more, on the podcast that I've done, either on my own podcast or on being a guest on other shows. Fool me once, shame on me. Yeah. Fool me twice, it ain't going to happen. And you can stand on that with a lot of strength when you know the facts and you really understand, you know, what has happened, and you can say that's not going to happen to us again.
That's right.
Chris, yeah. Thank you so much for getting up, because I know you're on the web. Was getting up early and joining us here today. Is the best place to get these books on Amazon, or do you recommend them somewhere else?
Okay, so the first book, you can get it directly from Skyhorse, down the COVID-19 rabbit hole. Skyhorse has it. Amazon has it. Barnes & Noble, some other entities that are allied with Skyhorse has it. The second one comes from a small press here in Victoria, British Columbia, called Ecstasis Press. And you have to go directly to them, unfortunately. But I mean, they're good. They'll ship it out, and it's not too expensive. And I think that one, the second book, is probably more reader friendly for people who don't have a science background. Although, you know, we try and provide that for book one, but it's, you know, if you want to know, gee whiz, I thought our media was totally a mess. Yeah, it is. Okay. And here's why. That kind of thing. You know, that book might be worth getting, because that's one I think that the people can digest without having to go through a lot of heavier sledding for the science part. But buy both, please. Buy both.
Okay, buy both. Well, and we will put both of those in the show notes when we put these out. So we'll have to get that written down and be able to have that.
I should mention, by the way, that all the funds, all the profits go to the Canadian Citizens Care Alliance. Steve Pellick and I make no money on this. It's all going to for us to do more studies and more books. We want to do one on mRNA technology, because I think that's an important one. We want to do one on bioethics, because bioethics have been twisted into pretzels over the last 5 years. And I think that needs to be revisited. Oh. And that's what we're going to do in the future.
Well, as you peel those out and as you get them done, circle back with us so that we can broaden.
Absolutely.
Out to our audience again, so they can really know the truth, because we have to get really solid in understanding why, no matter what the next one looks like, we're going to stand in unity and say no.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly. And that's the key thing, being able to say no, just no, not doing it. Yeah, that's resistance begins with no.
Exactly. I've said forever, the separation between my government starts at the level of my skin, you know, and we have to be firm about that. So as we close out today, I want to say a special thanks for everyone who joins us here every Monday morning, 11 a.m. on This Week with Dr. T. Super thank you to everybody who's a Tenpenny Prime member that supports us and lets us to do all these really great interviews and all the different things we post. We do podcasts 5 days a week, and we post on Substack 5 days a week. So it's a lot of work, and your support makes that happen. So Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining us here again. We'll be sure to get those publication things in the show notes so everybody can link to it. And with that, I want to close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close every one of my podcasts with this. If you've been following me for a while, you should have this one memorized. It's Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust Him for everything. He won't let you down. Chris, good luck with what you're doing. Good luck with your books and also with your future research, because it's so, so important. And to everybody else that's here, have a great week, everyone. We will see you tomorrow morning, Wednesday, at Morning Coffee with Dr. T. Open forum questions and answers. Bring your questions. We'll see you there. Have a good week, everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out: Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.